Good day to you. This is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. On today's show, voters in some California communities and in Boulder, Colorado, will decide on proposed soda taxes for their communities.
The evidence continues to roll in, and I think you can firmly put it in the column of sound public health policy.
Luke Runyon looks at the spread of soda taxes around the country. We make bone broth today with an educator at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Then tis the season for a big pot of ratatouille.
This is another recipe that you can use up all your garden produce or homeless vegetables in the bottom of your refrigerator.
Daniel Orr makes this recipe with a good friend in mind. And some of the world's biggest seed companies say they need to combine to meet the global food demand, but critics are skeptical. But first, it's news with Mark Chilla, and there are plenty of stories this week.
Right. We're taking a little extra time for the news update this week to talk about the presidential candidates' views on three ag-related issues. Neither the Clinton nor the Trump campaigns responded to Harvest Public Media's request for comment, so the reporters at Harvest research statements both candidates have made throughout the campaign season. Let's start with using biotechnology on the farm. Clinton made comments in favor of GMOs during a 2014 convention for the Biotechnology Industry Organization. There's much less material to go off of to establish Republican nominee Donald Trump's views on biotechnology in agriculture. The Iowa Farm Bureau asked candidates during the Republican presidential primary if they supported the use of biotechnology in food products and opposed efforts to require mandatory labeling for foods simply because they contain ingredients derived from biotechnology. Trump responded, yes. Meanwhile, Clinton said she supported USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack's efforts to pass a GMO labeling law. And how would the candidates support small farmers? Trump framed his support for family farms as part of his business and economy plan at an August campaign stop in Iowa. He spoke about peeling back federal regulations and lowering tax rates. He expressed support for the renewable fuel standard, which mostly benefits corn and soybean farms, and proposed eliminating a controversial update to the Clean Water Act. In Clinton's plan for a vibrant rural America, she lists specific proposals that she also says will boost family farms, and she specifically addresses both young and small farmers. Clinton proposes doubling funding for the Agriculture Department's Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program, and to increase funding for programs aimed at growing farmers markets and the local food systems. And what would the candidates do to clean up waterways? Another investigation by Harvest Public Media is at eartheats.org. Now taking a step away from the election, perhaps the biggest buzz this week came from this story. An investigative article in the New York Times found that genetic modification for crops grown in the U.S. and Canada have failed to reap the bounty that seed companies promised to deliver. The report compared two decades of crop data from North America and Europe, which has rejected GMO methods. The article said the amount of food produced per acre has been about the same on both continents, but herbicide use has increased in the U.S. by 21%, while use of those chemicals dropped by 36% in France, where GMO crops are banned. The article was based largely on a sweeping report from the National Academy of Sciences released in May of this year. But the story has come under fire for cherry-picking data to support its conclusions and comparing crop yields across a broad area without taking into account widely varying factors like climate, soil, pests, and farming techniques. Unsurprisingly, agribusiness giant Monsanto responded with its own selective sample of the same data and drew pro-GMO conclusions, and groups like the American Soybean Association have also blasted the article. But other journalists on the GMO beat have also taken the Times' conclusions to task. On WBUR's On Point program, Fred Gould, professor of agribusiness at North Carolina State University and the chair of the committee that wrote the National Academy of Sciences report, said data does show crop yields from GMOs have not increased overall. But he cautions that there are other important benefits to consider, such as a dramatic drop in pesticide use for cotton in China. And a quick correction. Last week, we talked about a food pantry opening on the campus of George Washington University. We said that tuition was $68,000 per year, and that figure is actually the total cost of attendance. Tuition and fees at GW are just under $52,000 a year. Let me direct you to more stories on the website. There's one about sourdough starters, which are like family heirlooms for home bakers. Now, researchers want to analyze starters to unlock their flavor secrets. It's at eartheats.org.
Hang tight, Mark. Later, we'll be playing a story you worked on about make your own bone broth.
Cool. Looking forward to it.
Public health advocates say soda taxes are an effective way to reverse the high rates of obesity and diabetes in the U.S. This November, they're pushing for new sugary drink taxes in cities around the country. If they keep up their momentum, a soda tax could be coming to a city near you. Luke Runyon has more.
The video opens with a woman sitting at a desk in an elementary school classroom. Sitting right next to her, a can of soda and a big bag of sugar.
I'm a nutritionist. I live and work in Boulder. Did you know that in just 12 ounces of soda, there's over 9 teaspoons of sugar?
She lists off other health problems from a sugar-heavy diet, says soda taxes are a way to fix them, and then delivers the punchline.
It's working in Berkeley. Let's make it work for us. Vote yes on 2H.
2H. That's the ballot measure the ad is persuading voters to pass. It would impose a 2-cent per fluid ounce tax on any sugar-sweetened beverage distributed in the city of Boulder, Colorado. That's everything from soft drinks to Red Bull to Gatorade to sweetened coffees.
So the choice is, do we want to pay pennies now upstream, or would we rather pay billions of dollars more downstream? That's the question.
That's Jake Williams. He's the director of Healthier Colorado. The public health group won't disclose its donors, but it's spent more than $600,000 pushing for the tax. Williams is convinced the tax will cut consumption and improve health.
The evidence continues to roll in, and I think you can firmly put it in the column of sound public health policy.
Other places around the country that say that this tax has worked, we don't believe that's the case.
Matthew Mosley is a spokesman for the No on 2H campaign, funded exclusively by beverage companies and distributors. In Boulder, the American Beverage Association has dropped hundreds of thousands of dollars to defeat the measure. In other larger cities, it's spent tens of millions. Mosley says this is about personal freedom. If it starts with soda, what's next? Pizza taxes?
And so where do we stop with that? You know, where do we stop with the kind of the nanny state telling us what to eat and drink?
Boulder's not alone in this fight. Three cities in the San Francisco Bay Area are also voting on soda taxes this year. And if they pass, they'll join the cities of Berkeley, Philadelphia, and the entire country of Mexico, which already have similar taxes in place. Even the World Health Organization recently gave soda taxes a stamp of approval. Lauren Hitt is a spokeswoman for the city of Philadelphia.
We've really turned a page in terms of this being more successful than not.
Once just a dream of liberals and progressive hotspots like Berkeley and, yes, Boulder, soda taxes gain momentum every time they're passed. The board president of Cook County, Illinois, just proposed a sugary drink tax for the city of Chicago and the county's 5.2 million people. And public health advocates hope that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Philly is pretty far from a liberal enclave. We have soda distributors that are based in Philadelphia. We have bottling companies that are based there. Like, all the things that you think might persuade people from getting on board with this tax have not. So I think it really does have legs.
That's after years of defeat for these kinds of proposals. Dozens of proposed soda taxes have been voted down across the country. Even in Philadelphia, it took three times for it to pass. That's why this election means a lot to soda tax proponents. If the four cities pass it, they'll be ready to shop the idea to other communities, eager to prove that it works.
We need more cities, or sometimes probably bigger cities, to pass a tax to have a more definitive answer on whether the tax works.
Chen Zhen is an economics professor at the University of Georgia and studies sugary drink taxes. He says the idea is still so new, economists don't have a great handle on what sorts of unintended consequences soda taxes bring. He says some evidence shows people just switch to other unhealthy foods. Still, he says the soda tax as a public health tool is hot right now and spreading fast.
20 years from now, the soda tax may not be crazy to many people at all.
And that means the real fight for soda taxes might just be starting. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
More coming up from Harvest and Luke Runyon on Earth Eats. Our recipe in two parts today. Ratatouille is best made in bulk and shared with friends. That's how Daniel Orr sees it. So we start this story by setting up the friendship that's at the center of it all. Daniel is Southern Indiana born and raised. He's worked in restaurants in France, the Caribbean, and New York over the years. He came back in 2008 to be closer to his family. And that's when he met Yael Cassander, a producer at WFIU Bloomington. She was born and raised in Virginia, also spent some time in France, moved to Indiana, and all along the way was a fan of Daniel's cookbooks. When they met, they were quick friends.
And she was actually the first one that interviewed me way back when I first opened the restaurant. And whatever she asks for, she gets. And she asked for the ratatouille recipe.
She sure did. Yael cooks ratatouille at home a lot, so she wanted tips from the chef about upping her game. Here's what he came up with.
I always suggest, there's no reason to make a cup of ratatouille. You know, you want to make a gallon of ratatouille. It's great on pasta, it's great in omelets, it's great in scrambled eggs, and it's great cold as a salad on its own. So I'm going to get started. I generally cook this on the stove, but since we're in a busy restaurant, in our pizza oven. I'm going to add the olive oil to a hot pan. Okay, and then I'm going to start adding my veggies. So I'm putting my garlic in first. Just going to spread that over the whole pan. Okay, and then the next ingredient is generally your onions. I'm just going to stir that around and put that back in the oven and let those onions cook until they're soft. All right, we're going to add the remaining ingredients, which are eggplant, zucchini, or you could use yellow summer squash, and we've got red, green, yellow, and orange peppers. So it's going to have lots of nice color to it. The other important ingredients are tomatoes, and I'm also going to throw some scallions, and I've got some golden carrots. So again, this is another recipe that you can use up all your garden produce or all of your homeless vegetables in the bottom of your refrigerator.
Stir those in, pop the pan back in the oven, turn the flame up, and cook that for 15 to 20 minutes, stirring every few minutes. As he said, we're cooking this in the oven today because the kitchen is just too busy. But yes, do this on the stovetop if you'd like. Or you can grill the veggies first and then combine them with the other ingredients to give it a nice smoky flavor.
So we've let these cook down quite a bit. You can see that it's about half the volume. I also added a bouquet garni, which is this herb bundle that's tied together with some butcher's twine. And then I tie it to the handle of the baking pan so I can find it very easily. And so that's rosemary and thyme. You could put bay leaf. You can put other fresh herbs like marjoram or oregano in there. And we're just going to kind of bury it in there. And that's going to perfume the ratatouille. And then a couple non-traditional items that I added are some orange juice and some orange zest. All right. And that's going to add a touch of sweetness to it. The zest is going to give it that beautiful floral flavor. Salt and pepper. And that is about it. So I'm just going to pop this back in the back of the oven for about another 5 or 10 minutes. We want it to kind of brown a little bit on top, get nice and thick. And you can see that tomato paste that I added, which I added about for this amount, about a cup, that really kind of brought everything together and made that nice thick sauce on it. So again, back into the oven for another 10 minutes, and then we'll see them on the other side.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll come back to the kitchen a bit later today. And actually, we've got another kitchen on our show. It's the teaching kitchen at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Want to learn how to make bone broth? Barbara Lair tells us how. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location available at whereisurgent.com. Every time we visit Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, they're doing something incredible. From cooking demonstrations to gardening classes, these classes are free and open to the pantry's customers. Many of the customers wander into the teaching kitchen from the pantry when they smell something good. What do we have today, then? It's squash soup on the stove and bones in bags on the counter.
My name is Barbara Lair. They call me the domestic diva. And every Friday, I give tutorials and demonstrations about foods that help heal our bodies. Today, we're doing a special topic on bone broth.
Barbara is one of the many volunteers who teaches cooking classes at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. And today, she's brought in a delicious squash soup prepared with her easy-to-make bone broth.
In my home, I have a stock pot going almost all the time. Even though that seems like an odd practice, that was the standard practice before 1930s. Everybody had it. As a matter of fact, I've seen an old-fashioned stove that has three burners and one hole. In that hole, you put a stock pot in, and you had perpetual broth going all the time.
People come to these classes to learn new, healthy recipes that they can hopefully incorporate into their life, like Michael Holland. He's one of the patrons at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
All the recipes I've found for it always have a bunch of sodium in it, and I can't have sodium. So I was trying to figure out whether or not she'd come up with a different way.
Bone broth is not only healthy, it's frugal too. You're using parts of the animal that you would otherwise just throw away. Plus, it's versatile.
Vegetables. You use it to make your rice, so you make a pilaf instead of straight rice. Broth is the basis of the best sauces, the best soups, the best gravies, the best stews. So if you go to a very high-end restaurant, they will boil their own bones. And that's why it tastes so wonderful.
Part of the mission of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard is to demonstrate just how easy it is for people to make their own healthy food using only simple ingredients. For instance, the ingredients of bone broth are really just bones, water, and thyme.
We'll take bones, we'll roast them, and then we'll put them in a pot, cover them with water, put it to a simmer, and leave it for 24 hours. When we roast them, it's because it gives it a kind of a nuttier flavor. It gives it more dimension to the taste. Some people will put a bay leaf in and peppercorns and a little bit of vinegar to pull the minerals out of the bones.
As Barbara explains, like any recipe, you can add your own personal touch to the broth.
But the basics are just bones, water, simmered.
The broth can last about 5 days in the refrigerator, 6 months in the freezer, and about a year if it's canned. It smells and tastes great, but it may not look that great after it's refrigerated. The gelatin from the bones makes its consistency a little like jelly when cooled.
It'll gel in the refrigerator. They'll freak out and think that it's gone bad when it's actually fantastic.
After the demonstration, Michael, our patron, gets a chance to taste that squash soup made with Barbara's chicken bone broth.
That's actually pretty good. No, you can taste the chicken. What is it, got basil and oregano? That's pretty good.
Now he has the recipe, plus he gets to take some beef bones home to try it out himself. And as Barbara explains, you can cook these beef bones about 3 times before all of the nutrients are out of them. After that, give them to your dogs. They'll love them. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
That story originally aired in 2014. Looking at the schedule of upcoming domestic diva classes, It'll be a tutorial on fermented cranberry relish on November 11th. We posted a link to Mother Hubbard's Cupboard on our Twitter page. Just search for Earth Eats. Some of the biggest agriculture, seed, and chemical companies are pursuing deals that could leave a market dominated by three giant global businesses. Company executives say growing bigger is necessary to keep innovating, but opponents say consolidation has many downsides for farmers and consumers. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer and Luke Runyon report.
Pretty much every food we eat gets its start on a farm. And pretty much all farms rely on seeds, pesticides, and fertilizers from a handful of companies. But farmers may soon have even fewer choices.
Deals on the table right now would pair up Monsanto and Bayer, Dow and DuPont, Syngenta and the Chinese National Chemical Company, known as ChemChina.
Regulators around the world have to approve these deals. But if they go through, some people worry the bigger companies will be powerful enough to squeeze farmers. Here's Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa.
You have less companies, you have less competition, and they're going to have higher prices.
Grassley's the rare Washington insider with firsthand ties to farming. He's generally a pretty pro-business kind of guy. But foreign takeovers and potentially anti-competitive moves worry him.
These mergers will change the game for farmers and, by extension, for all of us. Food, Grassley says, holds societies together.
Because of the old saying, you're nine meals away from revolution. And if, in other words, if you can't feed yourself or your kids, you might do almost anything to make sure that they don't starve.
Grassley chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I call the meeting to order. I'll give an opening statement and then because...
He held a hearing earlier this fall to get the companies on the record saying what their plans are and to acknowledge the significance of the proposed consolidation.
Among the witnesses Grassley called was Monsanto's chief technology officer, Rob Fraley. He told lawmakers his company needs to do more research. Right now, Monsanto spends just about one-tenth of what other big companies like Microsoft and Pfizer invest in research.
Agricultural companies like ours need to invest more if we expect to deliver what farmers need and do it faster. So Monsanto and Bayer are aiming for that goal.
Chairman Grassley and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Eric Fierwald, and I'm the CEO of Syngenta.
Fierwald promised his company's mission won't change if ChemChina is allowed to buy it.
Our deal will preserve investment in R&D and the safety, reliability, and diversity of the global food supply.
Of course, as these companies get bigger and have more products and greater market share, they potentially make a lot more money. So many observers are skeptical of the deals. Michigan State University professor Phil Howard has studied consolidation in food and agriculture companies. He says it dampens innovation.
Plus, he says these even larger companies would have a lot of political influence.
It will be harder for governments to say no to their requests for policy changes. It will be a company that's too big to fail, like all those Wall Street banks.
Even if these deals go through, there will still be smaller seed companies. But it'll become even harder for them to compete and survive.
Pat Mooney of the Canadian think tank Etcetera Group has been watching ag companies consolidate for decades. He says if they're allowed to go further, there's no reason the trend would stop with today's proposals.
This is not just three mergers we're talking about. We're talking about a transition from sort of the dematerialization of the farm into big data. And that's where this will end up.
Mooney says whoever has the data will be the real winner, whether that's the farmer, the major seed and chemical conglomerate, or perhaps someday the big tractor and combine manufacturers.
And Mooney wouldn't put his money on the farmers in that scenario. I'm Amy Mayer.
And I'm Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Amy and Luke, along with Chris, Jeremy, Grant, and Peggy, lots of folks at the Harvest desk to thank. Read more of their good work at harvestpublicmedia.org.
All right, so we've got that ratatouille out of the oven. You can kind of see it's a wonderful vegetable stew glistening.
Back at Daniel Orr's kitchen.
That bouquet garni, those herbs, you can really smell those in there, that nice rosemary aroma. Okay, we're going to finish this with a few fresh herbs. Really roughly chopped basil. Italian parsley. Now, to your ratatouille, you can add some other ingredients to make it a little more interesting, a little more fun, a little more unique. I like to add capers to it. I like to add black olives. You can also even add some dried fruit. Some raisins would give it a nice little sweet punch. And if, you know, and just a few, just throw in like a big batch, throw in about a half a cup. And when you get a hold of those raisins, it's going to give it a nice plump little sweet sugary bite to it. So it really makes it more complex. If you serve this cold, I also like to add some fresh mint, you know, so cool it down, fold in some fresh mint. It really gives it kind of an exotic flavor. So, you know, this is a nice base recipe. Make it your own.
And with that, he scooped a portion of the fresh-from-the-oven ratatouille into a quart container, and he asked me to deliver it to his old friend, Yael Cassander. So I hopped in my car and drove across town, balancing this tub of ratatouille in the cup holder.
Special delivery!
Hey, hi! This is so nice! Wow, so what have we got here?
So it's some eggplant, tomatoes, zucchini.
Oh gosh, and it's still warm. This looks beautiful. I am a ratatouille junkie, and I make it every week. So I'll be curious to see what Chef has produced here. The aroma is wonderful. I just wish I had a glass of red wine right now.
Is that an eggplant?
Mm-hmm. And it's so tender. I have to say, Chef, that I think you and I are French in our souls. And I remember very fondly going to the all-night bistro in Georgetown as a teenager called Au Pied de Cochon. I would steal away there at age 16, in the middle of the night. My parents had no idea where I was. We'd go, you could order ratatouille, omelets, and French fries. And we felt absolutely so sophisticated. And the only thing that would have made that experience more complete would have been if you had been there with me. But I think you were in spirit. Your version, though, is better.
Just get it straight out of the container.
How much can I have?
It's all for you. It's not too late yet to give up our
dreams. Live in the real world, get a job and go to sleep. Special thanks to Yael for her little cameo in today's show. And she thanks Daniel for the surprise ratatouille treat. If you didn't catch all the ingredients in that recipe, no problem. It's posted now at eartheats.org. And do check out all of Harvest Public Media's articles analyzing the presidential election through the lens of agriculture. Those stories also on our website. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. We're glad you joined the Earth Eats community today. We'll be back same time next week. I'm Annie Corrigan.